This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On today's episode, Peter Ames Carlin joins me to discuss his latest book, Tonight in Jungleland, The Making of Born to Run. Bruce Springsteen has produced so many albums since 1973. It's not so easy to rattle off all the names of the albums and the songs anymore. But there was a time back in the early 1970s when Springsteen had only two albums, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey, and The Wild, The Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle. But Springsteen was not so established and well-known after those two albums, even though some of us consider them masterpieces. His road to Born to Run, an album that really put him on the map, and the covers of magazines, was labyrinthine. The challenges were many and varied, but he remained sure-footed through it all. And part of the story of his ascension is that classic and iconic album, Born to Run. Peter Ames Carlin brings us the story of the making of this groundbreaking, epic album. Some of the anecdotes underscore what we know and love about the Boss. Many other anecdotes are brand new and detail the writing and recording of the songs in that collection. The processes were intense, and one wonders how it was that Springsteen could have persisted. Reading about the process of the making of this album somehow helps explain the ways that Springsteen can morph chameleon-like, and how he has managed to maintain his status as one of the most popular singer-songwriters today. Carlin helps us understand how it was that Springsteen could do all of those things he describes in the book, all of those things that occurred around 1975, to achieve such a tremendous status in the music world, but also his staying power. Indeed, he helps us see just how it is that 50 years later, we are still listening to and loving a pretty perfect album. Here now, my conversation with Peter Ames Carlin about the book, Tonight in Jungleland, The Making of Born to Run. So, Tonight in Jungleland, what is this book about? How in the world do you answer people who ask you, hey, Peter, what is your book about?
Well, it's about the making of Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run album, which was, you know, obviously an iconic piece of work, which, you know, people still listen to and think about and talk about 50 years later, but also was a real turning point in his career, because up until that point, Bruce was not what you would call a popular recording artist. He had a cult audience in certain segments of the country and was critically acclaimed for certain. But when his first two records came out, neither of them sold anything like the expectations of what the record company assumed they were going to sell. So I think he maybe topped out with about 20,000 copies per album, which was, you know, not much now and even less in the early 1970s. After being essentially told that he had one last chance to make a single that could theoretically work on radio, or else the record company wasn't even going to pay for him to finish making a full third album, Bruce got to work, and the first song that they worked on, and it took him months to record, was the title track, Born to Run.
What was happening in Bruce Springsteen's life long about 1973, in this period of time after the release of the first two albums, and the dreaming and the planning and the moving toward whatever the next album would be, which ended up being Born to Run? Because it seemed like there was interest, but it was going to be a very, very long slog.
Well, he was, I mean, in a sense, it seemed like a terrible grind, because he was just playing shows. He and his band would hop, you know, to rented station wagons and just drive from show to show to show. And that went on for years, you know, the first 2-3 years of his career. They were generally playing to pretty small clubs and the occasional theater around the country. But by and large, you know, I mean, it was just this endless touring and just playing over and over and over again, which was sort of how he built his audience, kind of hand to hand in these venues around the country. But you know, when you look back on it, it seems like it had to have been a terrible grind with so much uncertainty. But when I was talking to Bruce about it last year, he essentially said, listen, I was having the time of my life. I mean, all I wanted to do was play music and, you know, see the country and not ever have to get a job. And as a young person, I had kind of, as he said, my dream was kind of funkily coming true. And, you know, I mean, they stayed in sort of cruddy hotels, but on the other hand, as he pointed out, it's not like his actual apartment back in Asbury Park was much better than those places. So he felt pretty upwardly mobile, but he was also in this very sort of scary position of having spent his entire, you know, the last 10, 15 years of his life. And this is a 25-year-old man at the time, doing nothing but working and thinking and dreaming about being a rock star and, you know, being a recording artist and being able to write songs and, you know, and have people, you know, listen to them and interact with them. And so for him, the prospect of losing his record contract and his career to that point was terrifying. It was an existential moment for him because he was either going to become the person that he had been preparing to be for his entire life, or, you know, it was going to blow up in his face and he'd have nothing. And it was a terrifying notion for him.
So there's so much about this grind and the uncertainty and, you know, the band members, you know, acting up and needing to be paid and sort of being at the whim of DJs and radio stations and fickle executives. I mean, it was like, man, at every turn. But I love a book that uses the word ensorceling.
Ah!
Because
thank
it's
you.
Perfect. And it characterizes, oh man, the ways in which Springsteen was so early on in his career as a performer, just a master somehow of drawing people in. What is the magic? Can you tell me what is this ineffable thing or this X factor that people could so easily perceive even back then?
Well, you know, to people, you know, I spoke to a lot of the folks who worked with him in the earliest days. And even then, you know, when he was just the skinny young kid who hadn't really, you know, sold a lot of records or really achieved much, he was such an accomplished performer. And so deeply involved in what he was doing and thinking of it in terms of its meaning and taking it very, very seriously to the point where, you know, unlike virtually every other rock and roll musician of the time, you know, he was not interested in drugs. He was not interested in drinking a lot. He didn't even, you know, he didn't own a car, let alone drive one. I don't even think he had a driver's license until he was 22, 23 years old. What he was doing was his music, and that's all that mattered to him. And when he would draw people into his inner circle and, you know, and they got a face full of his charisma and his desire and his work ethic and just, you know, how seriously he was taking his job, though also, you know, not in a joyless way. It was a very joyous thing for him, but he was so focused and so committed and so determined to make it happen. You draw people in, and, you know, and I would hear this repeatedly. They'd say it was like a religion. You know, Bruce was kind of the center of everyone's life and their days, and you were happy to do it because he was such an exciting and engaging character. So there is just, you know, and it's like, what is that? I mean, you describe the X factor. There is a kind of X factor at work, which is, it's a kind of magic in a sense. I mean, what makes a person so magnetic to other people? It's really hard to, you know, you can't just create that person. You can't go to school to learn how to be that guy. You either are or you aren't. And from his earliest days, you know, these people who were, you know, working alongside Bruce, they were like, yeah, no, he was always that guy.
What I appreciate about him, among many other things, is that he's a guy who just likes what he likes. And like some of his musical influences, he was not going to be deterred from staying with these musical influences and sort of making them work for him. But I was thinking about how the first two albums, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey, and The Wild, the Innocent, and the Street Shuffle. How they are so different, and I'm stating the obvious, of course, and everybody said this before, so different from Born to Run. But what is that turning point? I mean, obviously, he knew he could gain some commercial success or he could land a better deal. And that's a big motivator, I suppose. But do you think he lost anything in that transaction? Or do you think he still was able to, based on reading your book, I know my answer, but that he could stay true to himself?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there was always a great reaction in Bruce to the idea of selling out or essentially trading off parts of his artistry for success. There were a lot of things that he was not willing to do in order to become popular. And there were certain things that he would sort of hold his nose and do, a lot of which in the earliest days involved, you know, the typical stuff you have to do to, you know, glad hand the people at the record company, to go to, you know, radio stations and endear yourself to disc jockeys and to record store owners and to the type of people that fuel your career. But when it came to compromising his music or changing anything just to become more popular, that was not something he was willing to do. He would do other stuff for sure, and he would work harder than anybody. But there was always this terror. I mean, especially in those days, you know, in the sort of post-Woodstock, early 70s era, this idea in the culture that there was something anathema about a rock and roll musician who pretended to be substantive, but ultimately would cash out in any way that they could to, you know, to gain more success and make more money and become more popular. He very much resisted becoming that type of person or being perceived as that type of an artist. And so, you know, though that he was focused on trying to distill his vision into something that would sound at home on the radio, that was never going to be at the expense of the depth of what he wanted to say or what he was trying to communicate. I think all he really wanted to do, and I think what he understood, was that he still had a lot to learn about writing powerful, effective songs that were going to communicate the depth of what he was feeling and thinking without necessarily compromising the integrity of what he was trying to do.
You know, what's so interesting to me too, so starting from the time I'm like in the eighth grade to today, when I've read about Bruce Springsteen during the early and lean years, my sense of him, there's always this description of him as this wiry guy who's sort of, you know, very hyperactive. He couldn't sit still and was really consumed with the idea of playing music and performing. But then other times, he sort of described as this very pragmatic guy, and there's a level of stillness and focus, I think, that somebody needs to do the things that he did, even in those early years. There does seem to be some consensus, I think, that he was this person with his spiral notebook and his copious notes and his maybe, you know, obsessive ideas about creating songs. And when you read the lyrics sometimes, they don't land in a way that might be super impressive if you're just reading the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And other times there's sheer poetry in the lyrics. And I would not say that there is an unevenness in him. I think it's all great and it's all good. It's just he seems to have these different faces and moods and voices and sensibilities sort of switching channels all the time. And I feel like there, and even within Born to Run, of course, I feel this, but I wonder sometimes about this as a sort of a thing that keeps or kept people back then from really understanding him. And by now, not to jump too far ahead, he has sort of trained us. He has sort of trained us to just accept that it's going to all be very diverse.
Well, when you're first beginning to know, trying to get to know an artist, you know, you're always looking for some, you know, some context to put them in. Like, what exactly am I getting into here? What is this person trying to do? Like, what, you know, what's the point of all this? What do I need to understand in order to really comprehend what's happening here? And what made it difficult, I think, for people in pop music and, you know, in the pop music industry in the early days was that Bruce was about five different things at the same time. At first, you know, people would talk about him as the next Bob Dylan, that he was this very sophisticated singer-songwriter who wrote these incredibly elaborate lyrics that were, you know, aspired to a kind of literature. But at the same time, he's got this band that plays this jazzy kind of speedy music that's as much rhythm and blues and soul music and jazz as it is rock and roll, even though it's all those things at the same time. So it's like, well, wait, how exactly are we going to slot this guy into our system? Like, who is he exactly? And what exactly is he? You know, I mean, it was hard to say. If you listen to those early lyrics, to those early songs, you know, these songs are like these elaborate constructions like Rosalita, New York City Serenade. You know, I mean, these are really cool poetic songs, but they just go on and on, and they have different sections and you know, and make these weird transitions that you're kind of not quite expecting. And what he was learning how to do was to write in the same amount of depth and talk about his characters and their feelings and adventures, but in a way that felt more direct and was sort of more of a distilled version of what was taking him, you know, half a dozen verses and two different instrumental sections to, you know, to establish in his earlier songs. So yeah, there was, you know, it was that complexity and the diversity of his influences and sounds that I think became confusing to people, made him so hard to quantify. Though eventually, I mean, once he reestablished himself with Born to Run and became this kind of neo rocker, you know, who was combining, somehow finding a way to weave together the visceral excitement of Elvis and the first generation rock and roll stars with Bob Dylan's, you know, very literary, poetic and artistic songwriting.
Yeah, it seems like he wasn't trying to manufacture an image. He was just who he is, and so complex. I mean, it was just this sort of kaleidoscopic thing. I want to talk to you about this big idea of revision. I remember so much of my early life studying Bruce Springsteen, you know, in Cream magazine articles and Rolling Stone and then the book by David Martin, all of that, the whole thing. I would read about the long, agonizing sound checks in these places where he performed. I would read about the many versions of songs. We read about this in your book as well. And I learned much, much more about this idea of revision in your book. Mm-hmm. When I think about Bruce Springsteen today at the age of 75, I still think of him this way as a man of revision, even though he certainly just seems to be enjoying who he has become, who he is, maybe who he's always been. And it's not reinvention necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's different. It's revision. And the thing is, revision is hard. You know, maybe in any context, revision is hard. But what can you tell me about this idea of revision? It's like a dissertation, please, of revision. And how it is actually something so natural for this man. Maybe a curse sometimes, maybe a blessing, maybe just a way of being. If I say to you as a free association about Bruce Springsteen, the word revision, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he was willing and in fact expecting to work that hard. I think that especially as he got into the third album, you know, this attempt to make Born to Run, one of the things he began to understand was as easily as he could crank out songs, what he really needed to be able to do was to have it be more difficult and rewrite and rethink and redo and reimagine again and again and again until the flow on the page is, you know, that much more, you know, smoother and more powerful than before. And I think, you know, as a writer, you know, or somebody who tries to write words for the page, it's like, you know, whenever you read anybody else's work and it feels so effortless and conversational, the first thing you can assume is that the amount of work that went into it was anything but effortless. That the easy, you know, that the more natural something seems to flow on the page, the more labor and just backbreaking going over it again and again and again and again and again, you know, has taken place. So in a sense, when you hear songs like, say Thunder Road or Backstreets or, you know, She's the One or any of the songs that came after that in Bruce's career, it's like, yeah, they sound like they've always existed, like they were just out in the ether waiting to be discovered because they're such essential and pure expressions of rock and roll spirit. So, but of course, it didn't just fall out of the sky onto the page. I mean, he spent months reworking and rethinking and doing these things over and over again, and really bringing a really strong work ethic to this idea of making visceral, powerful, you know, what feels like intuitional art, and actually laboring over it, you know, like Scrimshaw. I mean, just getting every single little line of it exactly right. But it was, you know, he sees that as his job. I mean, there are other people like to, you know, some artists, you know, especially in rock and roll, you think of as shambolic, you know, like they just humble, or, you know, like they're messed up in some way, shape or form. And that's kind of part, you know, that's part of what makes it exciting is how close to destruction these people are. Whereas Bruce was always eminently in control. And sometimes to a fault. I mean, sometimes his need to control things, his need to overperform and outdo anyone's expectation of him, you know, he would do that to a fault. I mean, because that was his self-destruction in some ways, was his need to, you know, to be, you know, to sort of enact this image of, you know, a prisoner of rock and roll, as he put it, who is in some ways sacrificing himself to thrill his audience, you know. And you would see him at the end of these 3-hour shows, the 3.5-hour shows, just completely drained, seemingly barely able to stand up and hanging on his microphone stand. And, you know, there were times when it felt a little frightening, like this guy was really, really trying to obliterate himself on stage.
So fast forward, beyond now leapfrogging over many, many other albums. In the book's epilogue, you talk about having had the opportunity to talk to him many times over the years and write another book about him, but also this one time in 2024, and you're sitting in front of the fire for a long while before you pack up your things and you're walking back out to your car, and he tells you about this kind of ritual thing, August 25th, this ritual of driving in Long Branch and the West End Court, listening to Born to Run, and what it feels like to sit there and listen all the way through to Jungleland. But tell us what it means to you to listen to Born to Run and Jungleland and all of these songs in 2025, when this guy is still out there on the stage performing, yeah, still highly relevant, still highly creative, still making record after record, still touring, still thrilling fans. But all of that aside, to go back to the basics and to these most essential things, what does it mean to you to listen to Born to Run?
Well, it's such a clear portrayal of how it feels to be alive and young and maybe not even young anymore. I mean, one of the interesting things about the most recent tour, it was the way that he took Backstreets, which is a central part of Born to Run, one of the real pillars on the album, and turned it from a song about lost love and stolen innocence into a sort of a meditation on grief and loss. You know, the types of things that you experience so much more when you're more toward the end of your life. As we are, you know, I mean, obviously 50 years down the road, Bruce experiences a lot more loss of, you know, friends and former bandmates and just, you know, loved ones in his life than he was as a 25-year-old, where, you know, and at the time he was more concerned about like how to become, you know, as a young man, how do you become who you need to be in the context of a society that seems to be limiting, full of barriers and full of economic, you know, at the time, you know, frame. I mean, the sort of collapse of the American frontier to some extent that people were experiencing in the early 70s. And now he can take those same songs and play them from the other end of his life and have them still be as meaningful and powerful as they were, you know, in their original performances, because the songs are big enough and full up, you know, so full of feeling that they take in all these different aspects and different experiences that people have. So for me, you know, I mean, I first listened to Born to Run when I was a teenager, and now, you know, I'm significantly older than a teenager. I'm in my early 60s, and yet that album still, when I listen to it, it still feels as relevant and as full of feeling and, you know, the stuff of life and love as it ever did when I was an adolescent.
Peter Ames Carlin, thank you so much for talking to me today. What a thrill. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Peter Ames Carlin is the author of Tonight in Jungleland, The Making of Born to Run. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Write to us at bookpublic@tpr.org. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.